Our next panelists are Sean Gordon and John Allerding. Sean Gordon is a partner at Thompson Hine, where he is a member of the firm's Business Restructuring, Creditors Rights, and Bankruptcy Practice Group. He focuses on bankruptcy reorganization and litigation, creditors' rights, loan restructuring and workouts, foreclosure, and commercial and real estate litigation. Mr. Gordon represents lenders, corporations, creditors, committees, trustees, individual creditors, lessors, lessees, debtors, and landlords, both inside and outside of bankruptcy. He has broad experience in federal, state, and bankruptcy courts throughout the United States. He also concentrates his practice on defending lenders and mortgage servicers in actions brought by borrowers asserting mortgage-related claims. He is a graduate of Case Western Reserve University School of Law. John Allerding is counsel at Thompson Hine, where he is a member of the firm's Business Restructuring, Creditors Rights, and Bankruptcy and Business Litigation Practice Group. He represents clients in a wide range of industries on a variety of different matters, including commercial and creditors' rights, bankruptcy, distressed and special asset workouts, drafting and negotiation of asset purchase agreements, preference actual litigation, fraudulent transfer litigation, uniform commercial code disputes, assignments for the benefit of creditors, commercial litigation, among others. Mr. Allerding has received significant recognition for his commitment to pro bono services and access to justice. He is a graduate of the University of Michigan Law School. We are pleased to welcome these distinguished authorities to our faculty. Gentlemen, I'll yield the floor to you.
Thank you very much, Jim. This is Sean Gordon from Thompson Hine. I'm here along with my colleague and friend, John Allerding. I also want to say thank you to Nick, Bob, and Jay for the interesting presentations and informative presentations concerning insurance policy and coverage issues. The only thing I can think about that is just as exciting as insurance policy coverage issues is bankruptcy, and that's what we're here to talk about today. So thank you, and we'll try to get through this in 30 minutes or less as slated. In our presentation today, we're going to consider the current landscape and state of the bankruptcy world in light of the pandemic. We're also going to cover some basic bankruptcy concepts as well as strategies that can be deployed with respect to bankruptcy claims in this challenging and difficult environment that many of our clients are facing. So without further ado, we'll move on to slide 2 of our presentation that discusses some of the statistics showing that bankruptcy filings are, not surprisingly, on the rise since the shutdown started in this country. As the pandemic slammed the U.S. economy, there were increased filings to levels that are similar to what was recorded in the wake of the last recession. Specifically, last month, there were 722 businesses filing for bankruptcy protection. This represents a yearly increase of 48% in those filings. It's up from last month, 28% from April of 2020. And just to give you a little bit more context, that matches the filings from the tally in May of 2011 during the last recession. So clearly there's something off in the economy, and it's not surprising. What the professionals in this industry are anticipating is that as the government programs, PPP, et cetera, other things start to taper off. Also, when public companies start reporting their second quarter earnings towards the fall, we are expecting more filings on the horizon. Moving on to slide 3, the downward trends that we're seeing, and there has been, you know, what appears to be some brightness behind the clouds. The current employment rate for May was at 13.7%, which a lot of folks were surprised that improved from April's 14.7%, went down just a bit. But I would note with caution that there has been some speculation that the May 2020 rate of 13.7 is actually maybe closer to 16.3 based on what some are saying are misclassification issues, but that's not certain. The numbers, as you know, with unemployment can be iffy sometimes, and sometimes there are adjustments. The majority of industries that we see filing Chapter 11, not surprising, leisure and hospitality, retail, energy, professional services, many of the bigger names that you've seen in the news lately, Hertz, J. Crew, JCPenney, Frontier Communications, Gold's Gym, Neiman Marcus, just to name a few, this is really having a big effect across our economy. In our practice, what we're seeing in the commercial lending landlord representation space, a lot of requests for payment deferrals, trying to kick a can down the road, working things out in the hopes that business will start to return to normal. But this, you know, the lengthy shutdown, just simply not having cash flow for so long, the piper is going to be paid at some point, or in many cases is already being paid. So what are some of the things that we can think about for our clients? Moving on to slide four, preventative steps, and this would be for trade creditors or landlords. You want to think about changing payment terms if your contractual relationship permits, for a couple of reasons. One is you get paid. Also, if you can move to CIA cash in advance or COD, as John is going to talk about later, that may serve as a defense to clawback of payments if they're made within 90 days of the bankruptcy filing. You can also see guarantees from parent corporations, try to get credit insurance, take some collateral or letters of credit, whatever you can get. And another thing to consider is thinking about, you know, can you end the contract? Take a look at the termination provisions. If you can get out of a bad situation with your client leading up to the bankruptcy filing, that might be the best option depending on the circumstances. Moving along to slide five, in terms of secured lenders, things to think about, as I mentioned before, trying to get as much additional collateral so you have a better claim in the bankruptcy case as a secured lender as you can. Make sure that you're properly perfected. Once the bankruptcy is filed, your perfection status as a secured lender is subject to challenge by the Chapter 11 debtor or a trustee in a Chapter 7 case. And one thing that that lenders may want to consider is simply selling their paper. That's a way to get out of something that's in a bad situation. But obviously, in the current environment, the consideration for that may be lowered as compared to normal times. For companies that are in distress, if you're representing a debtor, consider voluntary workout options and assess the best restructuring option that's available. Before we get into what some of those restructuring options are, moving along to slide six, just some basic concepts and key terms that apply to bankruptcy. Everybody's heard of Chapter 11. It can be a reorganization through a plan of organization, reorganization, or it can be a liquidation through a plan. The key characteristic of a Chapter 11 is that the same management that caused the problems in the first place or was running the company as it filed for Chapter 11 remains in place in most circumstances unless there's a Chapter 11 trustee appointed, and they proceed as a debtor in possession. Chapter 11 can also be available to individuals, the Mike Tysons of the world, who have filed for Chapter 11, usually high net individuals, going to Chapter 11 based on the Bankruptcy Code's requirements. And you've got Chapter 7, which is a straight liquidation for either businesses or individuals. The interesting thing about Chapter 7, you get a discharge of the debts at the end of the day for individuals. Corporations, on the other hand, do not get a discharge in Chapter 7. They can through a Chapter 11 plan, but in Chapter 7, basically the entity is just left being an empty shell. Chapter 13, which folks hear about, and this comes up in my practice in the mortgage space a little bit more, individual reorganizations, you know, similar in some concept to Chapter 11, but just for not the high net individuals, folks that want to keep collateral like a car or a house will reorganize through Chapter 13. Some other terminology, debtor, any entity that owes money, creditor, the party that is owed money to. When a bankruptcy is filed, an estate is created. It's a very key concept in the bankruptcy world. It is an estate that consists of all assets and interests of the debtor that existed as of the day that the bankruptcy was commenced. Trustees, as I mentioned, they can be, they're always in Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 are appointed. In Chapter 11, they can be appointed if there is concern by creditors or other parties in interest that the debtor is not managing the business properly and if there are concerns over fiduciaries not doing their job on the part of the debtor in possession. Secured, meaning secured creditor, some kind of collateral, you get secured status. Always better to be a secured creditor in a bankruptcy case than unsecured, where you are sharing pro rata with other unsecured creditors based on your claim and receive, you know, usually a very small percentage on your claim depending on the case. Moving along to slide number seven, some of the restructuring options to consider for clients that are facing financial difficulty. Chapter 11 bankruptcy, as I mentioned before. There, you know, you could go through Chapter 7 liquidation. Out of bankruptcy, there's assignments for the benefit of creditors, not always through a court process. Some depends on state law. And then you also have receivership that is a creature of state law and can be conducted in state courts. But the big difference there is you don't get the benefit of an automatic stay that we're going to get into that is nationwide. If you're filing for a receivership. There are also out-of-court restructurings, forbearance agreements, refinancings of debts. If you're representing a secured lender, Article 9 sales of collateral, and just state law orderly wind-downs for clients. Moving along to the next topic, in terms of how the bankruptcy case is commenced, starting on slide 9, a bankruptcy case is commenced with the voluntary or involuntary petition filed by creditors. The petition itself is just a form promulgated by the federal government. It's a couple of pages. But in a Chapter 11 case, you'll often see many first, what they call first day motions and pleadings filed seeking various relief so that the case can operate smoothly. And that could include debtor in possession financing motions, motions to employ professionals, critical vendor motions. Some of these concepts we will get into a little bit later in the presentation. It usually takes a lot of planning to prepare an organized Chapter 11 filing, but we do see cases where businesses simply run in when there's an emergency. If there's a foreclosure or some kind of sale of their collateral that's happening, they can stop it with the bankruptcy filing and filing the voluntary petition. As I mentioned earlier, no trustee in Chapter 11 typically. It's debtor possession, business as usual. The more sophisticated and organized the filings tend to be, the lower the risk is for suppliers that would continue to supply goods or services to the debtor during the course of their bankruptcy. The court and all stakeholders during the course of the Chapter 11 would be educated as to the company's plans. Moving on to slide 10, the automatic stay, the underpinning of the entire bankruptcy process. You have to stop the collection activity. And under Section 362 of the Bankruptcy Code, there is a very, very broad injunction that gets put in place when an individual or an entity files for bankruptcy that automatically stays any kind of collection action. It stops foreclosures, it stops evictions, contract terminations, and it applies no matter what, even if the party has not received notice of the bankruptcy. If you are representing a creditor and you've taken some action because your client didn't get notice or was not aware, you may not be subject to sanctions, but any actions you would take in violation of that injunction would be void. Moving on to slide 11, there are exceptions to the automatic stay. In fact, there are 28 of them enumerated in the bankruptcy code. The police powers exception for criminal actions, various domestic matters, if there's EPA enforcement, things of that nature, you may not need or your client may not need relief from stay. If there is no exception, a party to take action against property of the estate to try to collect or take back collateral, you have to seek relief from stay and file a motion and comply with the notice requirements under the bankruptcy code and the bankruptcy rules. One thing to note is that the automatic stay only applies to debtors and property of the estate. You can still pursue guarantors outside of the bankruptcy context. Sometimes the automatic stay could be extended if you're in a Chapter 11 case for a company, may be extended to individual guarantors if a lawsuit against them would seriously impact the running of the case. But those circumstances are usually rare, and guarantees are usually fair game to go after. Letters of credit, credit insurance, other things. And one thing for purposes of today's CLE, insurance proceeds. If you are a loss payee on insurance policy and the debtor is not to receive any of the insurance proceeds, there is a very strong argument that the automatic stay would not apply in seeking recovery under that policy as a loss payee. However, if the debtor is named in part as a payee of the proceeds of the policy, it's always wise you need to get relief from the automatic stay before any request is made from the insurer. Moving on to slide 12, debtor in possession financing. This is the mechanism by which companies in Chapter 11 that have run out of cash get cash to operate, to hopefully reorganize or liquidate and maximize return to creditors. Very often the lender that provides this financing is the same as the debtor's pre-petition lender. In an ideal world, that would be provided on an unsecured basis and be treated as a normal priority claim, but the reality is that never happens. There's usually many, many protections provided to DIP financing lenders. In moving on to slide 13, some of those protections can include a super priority administrative claim in the case where they're able to recover, the lenders that's providing DIP financing can recover faster above and beyond everybody else. Getting a lien on the debtor's unencumbered assets, and potentially getting liens on debtor's property that is otherwise encumbered. If these items are not available, the court can grant DIP lenders a super priority or priming lien on all the debtor's assets, so long as other existing secured lenders are adequately protected, and that's an analysis that is very case-specific and based on the debtor's business operations. Moving on to slide 14, cash collateral. Debtor always needs cash to run its business, and it may have cash sitting in accounts as of the date of the filing. And typically, this will be encumbered by a secured lender's security interest, and oftentimes you'll see secured lenders resist the debtor's use of this cash collateral. There is a mechanism in the bankruptcy code for the debtor to obtain the authority to use the secured lender's cash collateral. The court will typically conduct a hearing if it's not by consent. The lender has to show validity, priority, and extent of its interest in the cash collateral, and the borrower has to show that the lender will be adequately protected, and that can be in the form of provision of periodic payments or replacement liens. Moving on to slide number 16 in our materials, discussing unsecured creditors committee. If you have a client that is owed money and it's an unsecured creditor, if the claim is large enough, that client may be invited to serve on the unsecured creditors committee in the bankruptcy case. It's a great way to get representation in the case without out-of-pocket legal fees and costs. There is an indirect cost as committee counsel is paid from the assets of the estate, which depletes the amounts available to distribute to unsecured creditors in the long run, but at least there could be no out-of-pocket costs. The Unsecured Creditors Committee in Chapter 11 cases is usually a very loud entity that does a lot of investigations and just monitors the process on behalf of all of the unsecureds to try to maximize return to them. Even sometimes in cases where a committee is appointed, there still may be no distribution for unsecureds. That does happen, but oftentimes you'll see the Unsecured Creditors Committee negotiate for at least something to go to the unsecured creditors in the case. And this is the entity that will frequently get derivative standing from the bankruptcy court to assert litigation against officers, directors, secured lenders, other creditors in the case. The last concept that I'm going to talk about is rejection and executory contracts, assumption and rejection of executory contracts and leases before we get into claims and litigation and bankruptcy, which John will go over with you. This is also, like the automatic stay, executory contracts and how the bankruptcy code treats them, really one of the most fundamental concepts of bankruptcy law. This is the process by which the debtor picks and chooses which contracts are profitable and which ones it wants to throw away. So if you're thinking about it, if you're a retailer and you have a series of leases across the country, you will either want to reorganize and continue operating with just the profitable stores and throw away those other leases, or alternatively, you may be selling the business and you only want to sell the profitable ones to profitable leases and contracts to maximize return. So the court typically defers to the debtor in possession in a Chapter 11 to make this decision based on its business judgment. If the debtor decides it's a great contract, they want to keep it, they file a motion to assume the contract, or there can be provisions and plans that deal with this in Chapter 11 plans. But if to the extent a contract is assumed, the debtor has to cure all monetary defaults that arose leading up to the bankruptcy filing, as well as any post-petition defaults, and also provide adequate assurance of future performance for that contract. To the extent the debtor wants to throw away the contract and reject it, on the other hand, it's just considered a court-authorized breach of contract by the debtor, and the party on the other side of that contract is simply left holding the bag with a pre-petition unsecured claim for damages that arise out of that breach. So that's my portion of today's presentation on bankruptcy, really just going over the fundamental topics. I'm going to turn it over to my friend and colleague, John Allerding, now, who's going to walk you through various types of claims in bankruptcy and also some issues that arise in litigation and related strategies. Thank you very much.
Thanks, John. And good morning or good afternoon, everybody. Again, my name is John Allerding. I'm counsel at Thompson Hines in our bankruptcy creditor rights restructuring group and also in the business litigation group. And as a lawyer, I feel necessary to start my presentation with a general disclaimer today that there are exceptions to every rule. The issues and circumstances we are discussing today vary widely, and that is particularly true as we face the COVID-19 pandemic. In our limited time together, we can't go through all the exceptions and nuances. However, our discussion today should provide you with a 10,000-foot view so that you can understand the general bankruptcy process that you may encounter during these uncertain times. So flipping to slide 19 is more of a title slide. I know we're getting tight on time, so I'll just have you go straight to slide 20. This discusses secured claims. These are claims that are secured by particular collateral. A secured creditor can look to recover from the liquidation of its collateral before any other creditor can recover from that same collateral. If the collateral is valuable enough to cover the entire claim, the secured creditor is considered to be fully secured and should expect a full recovery through the bankruptcy process. If the collateral is insufficient to cover the entire claim, the creditor is considered undersecured. And in this scenario, the court will bifurcate the secured and unsecured portions of the claim. The secured part of the claim will be treated as secured and recover from the collateral, from the full amount of the proceeds. The unsecured portion of the claim is treated as a general unsecured claim, which we'll get to in a moment. Important to the insurance topic that we've been covering today is the issue of security interest in insurance policies and proceeds. It's typical practice for a company's primary secured lender to take a security interest in all company assets, including insurance policies and proceeds of those policies. To avoid questions of whether policy proceeds are estate property, secured creditors typically require their borrowers to name the secured creditor as a loss payee on the company's policies that cover any sort of harm to the business itself. And I don't need to say this to you all, but obviously the policies differ widely among with respect to what they cover. I'm not at all suggesting that a secured creditor can take a lien on every insurance policy that's out there, but they typically will take liens on those policies that cover harm to the business under the theory that they have made the loans to the business and generally have a security interest in all assets. Flipping to slide 21. General unsecured claims are those that arise prior to the filing of the bankruptcy petition that are not secured by property, or as we discussed, could be the undersecured portions of secured claims. However, the timing aspect of that statement is a little bit misleading. Damages discovered after the petition date, you may hear me use petition date today, that would be the date that the bankruptcy is filed. The damages discovered after that date, but that is related to a pre-petition contract or tort, is generally considered a pre-petition claim. These claims only recover from estate assets that are not subject to security interest or liens of other creditors, or to the extent that a creditor was oversecured, these claims could be paid from the excess proceeds of that collateral. And they're only paid after a long list of priority claims, which include administrative expense claims, arising from the continued operation of the business during the bankruptcy process, and all the claims of the various professionals, including debtors, financial advisors, attorneys, brokers, investment bankers, and also the professionals of the unsecured creditors committee that you heard Sean talk about just a moment ago. For this reason, it's almost an absolute certainty that general unsecured claims do not recover in full. Their recovery can vary quite widely depending on how many assets the company had and what they're able to obtain in the liquidation of those assets. But many times, these recoveries will be less than 10 cents on the dollar, and that type of discount is what we refer to as being paid in bankruptcy dollars. Flipping to slide 22, to recover from the bankruptcy estate, the estate must know your asserted claim. This is generally done through either the debtor's scheduling of the claim, if that claim is evident from the debtor's books and records, or the creditor's filing of a proof of claim, which is a form, a pre-printed form that's widely available on the internet. While it's not necessary to file proof of claim, if the debtor does schedule your client's debt, best practice is always to do so. And so because of this, one of the first things to check if you have a client that is involved with a bankrupt entity is the bar date for filing proof of claims. You can seek to file a claim after the bar date, but getting permission to do so can be quite difficult. It's best to get something on file before the bar date, even if it's not perfect. For example, you might not know the exact amount of your claim at the time you file. And while you generally can't add new claims or theories of recovery after the bar date, you can amend your claim to provide additional details. So it's not even uncommon that we will file proofs of claim in amounts not yet determined. Flipping to slide 24, there are additional types of claims that are entitled to special treatment. Some of these claims receive priority over other claims. I'm going to try and fly through these. Reclamation claims are basically the bankruptcy code preserves a seller's pre-petition right to reclamation. 20-day admin claims, and I should say that there are time limits with respect to the reclamation claim provided for in the code. The 20-day administrative expense claim provides a priority claim for a seller of goods that the debtor received during the 20 days prior to the petition date. And although there's no guarantee that administrative expense claims will be paid in full because the debtor could be administratively insolvent, i.e. doesn't have enough cash on hand through the bankruptcy process to even pay back the administrative expense claims, these claims are generally considered to be fairly safe. Pipeline claims are those that result from goods that are in transit on the date that the bankruptcy is filed. Critical vendor claims can be asserted by the debtor. So if the classification that the debtor has to provide to a creditor, these are given to creditors whose services and goods are deemed essential for the continued operation of a business that's trying to reorganize. And a critical vendor claim can result in full payment of all pre-petition claims to that particular vendor on the theory that reorganization is good for all the creditors, so the other creditors shouldn't complain that this particular creditor is getting paid back at a different amount. On the other side of the spectrum, executory contract claims that arise post-petition are actually pre-petition claims. So again, an executory contract may be rejected post-petition, and the damages from that breach are paid back in those bankruptcy dollars that we talked about earlier. One of the most frustrating aspects of creditors subject to executory contracts is that this gray area before the assumption or rejection, a bankrupt debtor is not going to reject the contract on the petition date itself. There'll be some period of time. A creditor is generally required to continue performing under the contract during that time. However, the debtor is not necessarily obligated to perform its obligations under the contract prior to assumption and rejection. This can lead to incredibly frustrating circumstances that seem quite inequitable. There's case law going in both directions, but the general rule is, as I just stated, that the creditor must continue to perform under the contract. Claims for set-off may permit an unsecured creditor to effectively recover at a greater rate than other general unsecured creditors by reducing its own obligations to the debtor. Important to remember that the right of set-off requires relief from the automatic stay. And while the defense of recoupment is similar to set off outside of bankruptcy, there's one key difference within bankruptcy, and that's that recoupment, because it's deemed to be a defense, is not subject to the automatic stay. Flipping to slide 26, we'll talk about preferences and fraudulent transfers in a moment, hopefully. But claims against D&Os are an interesting animal in bankruptcy and may become even more interesting in the COVID world, where D&Os are forced to make decisions in an uncertain world, though with the same obligation to act in with good faith and with reasonable care. Because the harm caused by the D's and O's is really harm to the company, these types of claims generally are property of the bankruptcy estate and must be asserted either by the debtor itself, trustee in bankruptcy, or creditors can seek some sort of derivative standing through the bankruptcy court to assert those claims if the debtor won't do it. If a creditor suffers specific harm caused by a director or officer, for example, we brought fraud claims based on a particular creditor, on behalf of a particular creditor, based on actions targeted to, targeted at that specific creditor, the creditor will generally have standing to assert those claims against the director and officer directly. The automatic stay that Sean discussed earlier does not apply to third parties, but there are, again, exceptions to the rule where sometimes the stay can be extended to parties deemed so necessary to the bankruptcy process that the process could not be completed with, if they're distracted by a different lawsuit. Because the business generally suffers the harm and the creditors suffer the harm indirectly, the insurance proceeds that cover D&O claims should generally flow to the bankruptcy estate for distribution to creditors. However, if a secured creditor has an interest in the proceeds of the insurance policy, that secured creditor may be the only party that recovers. Because security interests and liens have a drastic effect on recovery throughout the bankruptcy process, those liens and security interests are always scrutinized in these cases. And there's, if there's a way to challenge a lien or security interest to try and avoid it, somebody will likely do that. Flipping to slide 27, suffice to say the bankruptcy rules, we have our own set of rules in bankruptcy. They generally adopt the federal rules. For most aspects of the litigation. There's also local rules in each of the different jurisdictions. Bankruptcy litigation can arise in either an adversary proceeding or contested matter. Adversary proceedings look like standard litigation. They just happen in a bankruptcy court. There's a complaint, an answer, discovery, dispositive motion practice, and eventually a trial. A contested matter is intended to move a little bit more quickly. It's initiated through a motion, and while Rule 26 discovery is available, the time frames are likely to be compressed by the court and the parties. It's the analogy to a melting ice cube in bankruptcy. You have some of these companies are just burning cash and need to get issues resolved immediately. There's no dispositive motion practice in contested matters, and the court may either hold an evidentiary hearing or can decide the matters on the papers. One of the particular claims that can be brought are preference claims, and I know we're at the 1:30 time limit, so I'm going to try and fly through. Preference claims can be extremely frustrating. They are intended to provide for equal treatment so that nobody gets preferred by the debtor, but in practice they're generally used by debtors, litigation trusts, and their respective trustees to recover property from payees that did nothing wrong and for which there was no actual intent to prefer. Some of the elements of the preference defense included that the payment made within 90 days on account of antecedent debt. 90 days of the bankruptcy filing on account of antecedent debt. The paid funds would otherwise constitute estate property. The payment was made while the debtor was insolvent, and the payment permits the payee to receive more than it would in a hypothetical Chapter 7. There are a number of defenses. Given that we're out of time, I'm not going to go through them. They're probably beyond the scope, to be honest, of what we're talking about today, but there are defenses available. There are also strategies to avoid preference exposure, such as getting cash on delivery, cash in advance terms. Fraudulent transfers are another type of claim. There are specific fraudulent transfer laws provided for in the bankruptcy code, and the code also codified state voidable transfer law. And with that, I think we are concluded. Just a minute over 1:30. I believe there was an anticipation that we would leave some time for questions. And so I will turn back over to the moderator to see if we have any questions. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, gentlemen.